Welcome, everyone, to the Imago Relationships Think Tank. Today is September 16, 2015, and this is Dr. Tammy Nelson. I'm your moderator for the Imago Think Tank, and I'm so excited for today's guest. I was just telling him that he is one of my heroes. And today we're going to talk to John Bradshaw. And John Bradshaw has been around for a long time. He's written so many books. He has influenced all of our careers. Anyone who is on this call has been influenced by John Bradshaw. If you have even talked about the concept of the inner child or the dysfunctional family, that came from John. So he has influenced all of our thinking in this field. He has written many best-selling books, and he has created many media catalogs full of great videos and television programs. He's written books such as Bradshaw on the Family, Creating Love, Family Secrets, The Path to Self-Acceptance and Reunion, Healing the Shame That Binds You, which I have to say changed the way that I did psychotherapy and also looked at my own family, Homecoming, Reclaiming and Healing Your Inner Child, and his latest book, Post-Romantic Stress Disorder, which I love the name of that book, Post-Romantic Stress Disorder, What to Do When the Honeymoon is Over, New Discoveries About Lust, Love, and Saving Your Marriage Before It's Too Late. I wish we had an hour just to introduce John and all the contributions that he's made in our field. He really has changed the way that we look at recovery, at the way that we look at family, at the way that we look at our own inner child, and the way that we look at healing shame and family secrets and reclaiming the right to heal. I would love to say all the things that you've done for us and for the field, John, and but I'm going to give you the opportunity to tell us about your work and tell us about you. And then at the end, I'm going to give people all your links and help you to promote your work and what you have going on now, because I think that's the most important. I just want to say welcome and thank you so much for being here. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Tammy. I could let you talk forever. That is great. A great promotion and introduction. I really appreciate it. No, I'm still clicking. I'm 82 now and got a lot of aches and pains, but I'm still, I just got through with writing the post-romantic stress disorder, which I had the title of that for about 5 years, but I didn't really have the empirical data that would support that title as a very serious title, not as just something that's neat and catchy. And it was through the work of Helen Fisher, who's a friend of mine, an anthropologist, and she made discoveries about the brain using fMRIs, and the idea that she, well, what she found is that there is a program in our brain that is like an instinct, and it is what supports what we call being in love. But kind of euphoria and the altered state that happens when you fall in love, and anybody that's ever done it knows the altered state, that you become, you become crazed about that other person, and it's almost impossible to do psychotherapy with people who are in love, because what happens when you're in love, you don't deal with any problems. So we're getting to Harville's impasse, but that doesn't happen for about 12 to 18 months after the in-love program stops. So when it stops, I call it post-romantic stress, because no matter how healthy or how much a person has a solid sense of self, they still will have a kind of shattering. Because one of the things that happens is a sex drive, which is enhanced by the in-love program, that sex drive wanes, you don't have the urgency anymore, or the reduced serotonin, which causes all the, you know, all the absolutely obsessive hawking and obsessive touching. All of that fades away, and it has to, because nature wants to prepare us to have a baby. And that requires oxytocin and vasopressin, different chemicals that from the in-love state, which is, you know, essentially dopamine and norepinephrine and reduced serotonin. And she found that these are three distinct brain programs. One, when you lust, which is universal. You see a hunk, you see a guy that, you know, you may not follow out, you certainly don't act on the lust unless you're single or whatever, and then there you better be careful anyway. But anyway, then you have the in-love program and then the attachment program. And the attachment program begins before you get married, generally speaking, but it is a distinct program. The mother and father are preparing for friendship, and they're preparing for loving a baby. And the nature wants to have families and wants to reproduce. So the post-traumatic stress is a serious state that codependents and addicts and people, you know, and I think most people have some degree of codependence, they're at highest risk for this because they don't have a complete self. I mean, my definition of codependency is it is a disease of the developing self that does not manifest until you get in a relationship. And that's awfully specific, but I think that's the way it works. You know, if I don't have a sense of self and you stop wanting me as much as during this 18-month period where you wanted each other all the time, then I will, you know, as a shame-based, codependent, recovering addict or addict, I was recovering, but you still have this intensity and panic almost when, you know, the night she says, let's just cuddle, that sort of terminates this pattern you've had of foreplay and sex. And it's a very intense period, and nature wants it that way, you know, because as Pat Love, your own Dr. Pat Love, says we have to meet, mate, and procreate. So that program is so strong. And that's a program that lasts after you separate or you get jilted. It's what causes stalking and domestic homicide and love suicide and all those terrible things. So it's not Mickey Mouse. Now, in the healing part of that, I refer in my new book to Harville's work, the Imago work, as one approach. My own inner child work is another one. Pia Melody's work at the Meadows is another way to approach it. There are several ways to approach a healing, because when you're in love, you don't deal with any real differences. When you get married, and Harville calls it the impasse, I call it the family blockade. But what happens then is not that symbiotic bonding, that baby talk, in love, obsessive, you know, cute little Gucci names and cutie pie. If you've ever been around a couple who are in love, it can get obnoxious. You know, with them saying all their cute little words and snooky bum and whatever. But once that program ends, then that intensity just wears off. And, of course, it has to if a man and a woman are going to get back to work and have a baby. And not everybody has a baby, but that's at least the general way nature is promoting our brains to meet, mate, and procreate. So the inner child work is the work you do when you wake up and you realize you have this impasse that you never talked about family of origin rules. You never talked about what happens after you get married. And nobody ever warned you that the sex drive was going to wane fairly dramatically in some cases. Because the dopamine enhances, it enhances the intensity of the brain, and you're in a complete altered state of consciousness. So that's where I see the inner child work coming in as almost the first thing to do. And at a certain point, I counseled over 20 years. I sort of estimated I'd talked to 2,700 couples in that period of time, some with lots of success, some with no success. Anyway, the thing that happens is when that wanes, everything has changed. You're not looking through those rose-colored glasses. You're not, you know, I had a woman who had been abused in 3 relationships. I worked with her for 1.5 years, thought I'd made incredible progress. And all of a sudden, she calls for an appointment. She comes in. I met the most wonderful man. He's the most honest man I've ever met. On our second date, he told me he had killed a man. So I almost fell out of the chair. You know, I pose it to you, therapist. What do we do? You know, it's so blatant. And she doesn't see it because she's in love. So, I mean, that is frightening, that you can overlook the most glaring things. He's a drug addict, you know, but I can change him. And love will conquer all. The in love, you think you can conquer all, but it's passing. It's transitory. So, you know, marriages settle in, and often after children are born, you lose a lot of that dopamine sex drive, and males especially maintain it, because woman's being prepared for creation of life. And that may be, you know, that may not be having a baby. It may be becoming a therapist. It may be an Alice Miller, or somebody that their work is their child, their product. So I just want to say that for people who are single. I mean, people who got married or who never got married, or people who never had a baby. So, but the inner child work then becomes absolutely critical, because you really haven't dealt with your family of origin differences.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just want to say something about that, because I think your work in this way really stands out as a new way to look at this. Because, I mean, you know, there's a lot of books out there about relationships and about marriage, but there's something about this book that's striking to me. You know, I've written my own books about monogamy and about sex, and we've all, as couples therapists, I think, done a lot of training, but there's something really outstanding about the way that you write about sex and about maturing into marriage, because you write about transitioning into independence and into as independence as a gateway to interdependence. So you're not talking about becoming more attached to each other, but rather creating these healthy boundaries where you get to self-differentiate, and in that way you become sort of attracted to each other again. And I love that idea. Way that you interpret those relationship differences, and you become healthy.
You know, the most profound thing I remember reading in Harville Hendrix was that marriage is the greatest psychotherapy you'll ever do.
Right, exactly.
You know, because you're going to have to work through all the family of origin rules, covert and overt, and then you're going to have to work through your wounds, a lot of which people don't really think is affecting their lives. You know, that their father abandoned them, or that they were abused physically, or they were abused sexually. Well, generally, a sexually abused person knows. But all of that has to be dealt with You know, and people don't want to deal with it. I don't want to go back to the past. I don't want to deal with the past. But the inner child is a magical way to get back there. And if I was writing Homecoming, that was my book on the inner child, and it's my most successful book. It was 3 years on the New York Times bestsellers. I mean, that amazed me. Anything that does that has to be grabbing people at some gut level. But anyway, I mean, it has been a bestseller. I wrote it in 1991 or two, I think. So, you know, it's 23 years old, and I still get, you know, sizable royalty checks and all of that on it, so it's still selling, you know. Shame, by the way, you mentioned Shame. That's my all-time bestseller. It just keeps selling.
Wow.
We call it the Energizer Bunny because it just keeps selling, and it sells more than any of my other books.
That's
Healing
incredible.
The Shame That Binds You.
I find that that book really relates a lot for men. Men really relate to that inner shame, that core of shame. That sentence right there, that little sentence then, that core of shame is so powerful. And in the book, in the Homecoming, where you say that that neglected, wounded inner child of the past is the major source of human misery. I mean, that says so much about Imago. It says so much about, you know, I think about it when I think about the conflict in the world. You know, it says
oh,
so
I do
much.
Too. I mean, mm-hmm. you could trace this kid, the wounded kid, to all the, you know, a wounded kid is quick to accept an absolute doctrine in late adolescence and have certainty because their self is so split, you know, by becoming a fundamentalist Muslim or an ISIS Muslim, you can feel like you are important and you have something to live for and you are whole, you're put together if you believe in their doctrine. And the same with Christian fundamentalists or any kind of, Howard Lipkin, I believe, wrote a book on brainwashing in Korea. And it was about how the steps that they go through to have a brain snap and suddenly embrace everything they're teaching to the point of be willing to go to death for it. You know, I can remember him saying, would you die for your Christian faith? And you know, I'm about 14 when they're telling me this, and I'd been thinking about dying for my faith. But the romance of that is very, very powerful to a person who has a wounded kid in there. And the other piece that I would add to Homecoming if I revised it would be all the neuroscience of the brain, where a guy like Alan S. Shore, UCLA, neuropsychiatric neurologist, whatever, he's done great studies on the brain, and he is talking about that the right brain is far more important than the left brain in healing, especially childhood, or essentially in childhood, because the child is dominantly thinking with their right brain until they're about 3 1/2. And then it's right and left brain, but dominantly right until they reach, you know, what Piaget called cognitive, or concrete operational thinking. That all the rest of it, you know, he talks about children being cognitive aliens. We have to understand that our kids up to 7 or 8 are, to some degree, cognitive aliens. They don't think the same way we do. And we have to learn how they think, which is mostly right brain. When I read all that, I suddenly realized, I've done the Inner Child Workshop, it's estimated for 500,000 people. Done it all over Europe and here in the States, and It is the most effective therapy I have ever seen. And I didn't believe it at first when I'd get letters from people. I just wouldn't believe the transformation that had happened by doing one 2.5-day workshop. But I began to believe it as I got more and more and more letters. I mean, we were getting 100,000 letters a month initially. It was like unbelievable. And then as years went on, I'd have somebody write me from 8 years earlier or 10 years earlier when they say, I did the inner child. This is what's happening in my life. It's been a total transformation in their lives. And I now could say unequivocally that I think inner child therapy is the most powerful work anyone could do. At least when you've got people with a lot of wounds, you know, they've been abandoned, abused, neglected, enmeshed, all of that, then you've got to get back to the child, and you got to get back through the right brain. That's the important piece. You know, so therapists could get my my PBS series on homecoming, or get the workshop. We have the workshop in tapes, and see how I did that workshop. I'm even thinking about making a kit for therapists, because that work was just so powerful, and I didn't know what was happening at first. I mean, I'd be honest with you. And then suddenly I started realizing this work goes right to the right brain. It's not left brain. It's right brain. Because I'm starting off going through each developmental stage, and that's what I do in that book. I say, you know, did you get your needs met as an infant? And then I have an exercise in the workshops where we play a piece of music, which is a recorded mother's heartbeat. And so we begin that meditation with the mother's heartbeat. And then we go on for a little while and just imagine the child as I have them go back and imagine being born. And see, that's all right brain. That's not linear and logical. You just have to let your soul stuff do its work. Because it's all there. It's all recorded. But we've tried to get at it with the left brain too much. In fact, so much that Shore and his colleagues say the talking cure is mostly out for early childhood work. I mean, later on when people have a much better sense of concepts and all of that, it can work, of course. But in childhood, and then when they have the child, you know, I have affirmations like, welcome to the world, I'm glad you're here, I'm glad you're a girl, you'll have all the time you need to get your needs met. And while those are linear ways of expressing it, when you're in a kind of altered state through that music, it can be very impactful. And then I play Fiona Knoll songs for the inner child, especially her first song, How Could Anyone Ever Tell You How Beautiful You Were? How could everyone ever imagine your loveliness? I'm misquoting, but I'm paraphrasing. And it's a real powerful song, and I have them hold a baby in their arms, you know, the pretend, imagined baby. But if we do the meditation right, they're usually getting back to a lot of nonverbal stuff. But, you know, you can't do that by just telling people to do it. It won't work that way. And I use music and poetry all through that workshop, which are engaging the non-dominant hemisphere of the brain. And I think that's why it's so effective. And that, you know, people will call me, I was in therapy for 8 years. And I don't want to brag about this because I, you know, at the time, I just didn't know what to make of it all. But they'd say, you know, that I got more out of this weekend. And I'd tell them, you know, this, once you start this work, it may take a couple of years for it to really be integrated into your life. So I'm not telling them it's some quick fix. But, oh my God, the impact is so astonishing to me. And so then, you know, in the inner child work, then you go through all the developmental stages that you get your toddler needs met. And in the workshop, I do go through what those needs are. You know, that's the no-no, I won't. It's mind states. And a lot of people just don't understand that that is just nature. That's the life force trying to separate and be somebody. Already in two-year-olds up. So I had a terrible time finding music for the toddler stage, because I think that's the stage where spankings started in my generation, and a lot of coerciveness and shaming. So you've got to get music to get you back there. And I had a lot of people sending me songs. But one day I got this song in the mail, and I was running out to drive, and I put it in my recorder in my car and almost had a wreck. It was Richard Wagner's Remember the Child song. And that song's available. It will really get people back into their nonverbal stuff. And he wrote that song and quit using cocaine the next day after he wrote the song.
Wow.
It was clean and sober. He used to come to my workshops and play the song on the piano once we really connected. And then he even wrote a song for the end of the inner child workshop. And then later he wrote a song which I use as the mother song in my workshops for healing the mother wounds. I have workshops on the inner child, which is kind of my main workshop, and then I develop workshops specifically related to mother, workshops specifically related to daddy, the father wound, healing the father wound, finishing the biz with mother, and those were equally as powerful, because in those workshops you have a deathbed scene where you say goodbye to your parents.
Wow.
Father or mother, and you know, a lot adds up to that. I'm simplifying it greatly here. But
John, let me ask you two questions
as
you're talking about this. First of all, it brings tears to my eyes to hear you say some of those things, because I remember some of that work. And, it's not easy, and it's very intense and very emotional, but incredibly healing. And so there's two things that I want to ask you are, one, I may have gotten this knowledge from you, I don't recall, but one thing I know is that at every age that your child is, it brings up your own issues from when you were that age. So
right.
It tends to happen in your relationship, right, when your kid is that age. And then my other question, you can address these two separately if you want, what is your feeling about a couple going through that deep inner child work together, witnessing it together? Does it make you closer? Does it make you bond? Is it something you feel like you should do separately and then come together? Because you talk so much about that sort of, you know, the differentiated work that you really need to do. And it used to be that you would go and do your work separately and then come back to have a healthy relationship. Now, with our work in Imago, we feel like, you know, we can help each other do the work. So I'm so fascinated by what you have to say about that.
Okay, well, I'll tell you my experience of it. Now, what was your first question again?
The first question was about, you know, getting triggered by the age that your children are, where that brings up all your stuff from that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that is the spontaneous age regression, you know, that you go into. I bet almost everybody who's worked with couples could say that about 80% of their problems were two kids fighting over who got the most. And, yeah, I mean, I see it clearly in the work I've done. It's just like suddenly they're two kids and they're fighting over, I spend time with the children, you never spend any time with the children. You know, you're spending all my money and you spend the money, blah, blah, blah. You have frequent flyer miles, but my wife and I had a fight over frequent flyer miles frequently. Over, I'm going to use your frequent flyer miles. I have to work. No, you're not. I'm saving those for my girlfriends. And then we both started laughing. Suddenly the adults take over. And, you know, you realize, who gives a damn about this, except it might save you money or something. But, you know, it's not important as to have a separation even for 6 hours with your wife or husband or friend or whoever. Anyway, I see the child, I mean, I remember a couple, two PhDs arguing over who got the green Christmas tree balls. And their divorce. It was like unbelievable. Guy was using oratory on her to claim that the green Christmas tree ornaments belonged to him. And it was just, I just sat there in awe. You know, you think, good God, what am I witnessing here? And the second part of your questions, simply the way I did it, and I may have steered people wrong, but the way I did it, and especially in the last 3 and 4 years of my counseling, me being, you know, the coach or the counselor, I would have them separate. I would have them work on inner child, like the woman for a couple of weekends, and the guy working on his own stuff, she's working on her own stuff, and then I'd have them come back together on like a third weekend, and he would tell her, with her doing nothing but validating. In other words, he would tell her stuff about his childhood that he remembers, or, you know, and I would talk to them about confabulation, that you may be making this up, so try to be sure you feel what you're saying. But anyway, they'd tell the husband would tell the wife about all his stuff, and she would just validate, you know, I see that you're so sad, or I see tears running down your eyes, and it seems like you're so sad. Just that kind of sensory-based validation. And then I'd have the wife share what she got, what she discovered about her wounded, how she discovered her wounded in her child. And so each would witness the other as they were telling about what they had discovered. And then we'd have, you know, I'd have them together again from then on. But being aware that certain signals or certain patterns could easily be the wounded inner child, you know. And so, you know, with an abandoned or neglected wife, even when he goes to the drugstore or goes to a ball game for 3 hours, she can feel intense abandonment. And they both have to know that that's a signal to reassure her, take her with you, whatever. you know, to really be overly sensitive to that wound. Because if not dealt with, pardon me, and without dealt with, it's going to cause automatic age regression. So that she's feeling being abandoned by her father and you're going on an overnight trip.
Mm.
Or vice versa. It could be the husband who was abandoned. And that worked incredibly well for me, but I'm not saying it'll work for everybody. But so first couple of weeks they worked on, and I either have an appointment with them or a couple of appointments with them to help them get back at that inner child stuff. And I did a lot of meditation, you know, kind of alter their consciousness just a tiny bit. Because you're trying to get to the right brain. That's the critical piece, that it's the part of the brain, you know, the right brain monitors all affect. So all feelings are being monitored by the right brain. And there's incredible stuff that happens to a person in their non-dominant hemisphere. Excuse me, I have a cough here this morning. But anyway, in their non-dominant hemisphere. And so to know that, that something seems irrational, this response is irrational. You know, I'd have them look for that when they thought a response was irrational. That was often a marker for some wound that the other person was experiencing.
So the right brain monitors the emotional reaction. You know, and you know, I really like that because it takes the responsibility back to the individual to monitor their emotional reaction, and it takes it away from their partner, right? Because it's usually the partner that's monitoring our emotional reaction, saying, "Why are you so out of control? Why are you?"
Yeah, and just you're sick. That's your sick family, you know.
Right.
Or they'll be talking to their friend. Yeah, that guy comes from the sickest family you've ever seen. It's always a way to, you know, make me right and you wrong. And
exactly.
As the statement is, there's no right and wrong in domestic, you know, unless it's clearly abuse. But there's no right and wrong in domestic affairs. They're just each one of you experiencing your own way, and that way can be severely contaminated by, you know, by your inner child. That's one of the, I talked about that at the beginning of the book, how the inner child contaminates your perception of things. And you've got to understand what's going on. See, most people don't want to take the time to deal with this. Because when you're in love, it's easy. There's no work. And, you know, I describe it as in love is non-working prelude to love. That is eros, long-term love. When you that ends, when that falling out of love ends, and a lot of people divorce. I actually wrote this book because I had seen something like over a quarter of the people that I counsel ended unnecessary, divorced unnecessarily. They were both still capable of a good, solid relationship. There were good reasons they were attracted to each other. The imago being the, you know, we know now that nature selects to a high degree because of the human lymphocyte antigen, part of the DNA, which monitors diseases and makes your offspring immune. The opposite, Klaes Wedekind study of sweaty t-shirt, found that every time they liked the smell of the t-shirt, the person had an opposite DNA, and that nature selects for, Pat Love has written brilliantly about this in her book, The Truth About Love, which was a wonderful book. I recommend that to everybody. But anyway, it's like there is, when you have chemistry for somebody, it's because your human lymphocyte antigen profile, which is part of the DNA that sorts for diseases, is different than their DNA lymphocyte antigen. And that way, your children have two times the immunity that they would normally have had. I mean, in other words, when you marry with opposite DNA antigen profiles, human lymphocyte antigen profiles, I know it's a big word, I don't know fully what it means. I just memorize them when I don't know what they mean. And just trust that these neuroscientists, you know what they're talking about. So anyway, but that's an amazing thing. Now, I think imago certainly comes in there, but that initial chemistry is just Mother Nature, man. She wants you to meet, mate, and procreate, and wants your offspring to have the best opportunity to survive. So a lot of, you know, my first half of my post-traumatic stress book is that Mother Nature's old black magic. Because I think a lot of times stuff is happening beyond our, I mean, I married two women. I'm still married to the second one in my life, and you know, I have to say that neither one of them purely fit my lust ideal. I mean, But I fell in love with him. And that's a powerful force. You know, Pat Love...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, Pat Love quotes that thing about their brain is a remarkable thing. It develops and develops and it develops until you fall in love. And then it stops.
Exactly. It makes it dumb. You talk about this three-stage model of true mature love.
Yeah.
After that dumb stage. And you talked a little bit about stage one. That's like your family of origin, like the conflict time.
Yeah,
that's
in other words,
from your past.
I don't think it's stage one in a marriage or a long-term relationship until the in-love intensity stops.
Yeah.
And now it's the Hatfields versus the McCoys. Now
right. we call that the conflict phase too.
Harville calls it the impasse. And
the power struggle. Yeah.
Now it's work. And to me, I think the first chapter of the second part, which is building on your attachment program, I talk about effective communication skills. I think it was Gottman that said marriages live and die by how they argue. A lot of people argue, but they don't argue well. They just keep having the same fight over and over again. But if you can argue well and have some kind of resolve and compromise, you know, for the second part of once you get married, you need to have docility, the openness to learn new things. And people make their family of origin stuff, they talk about it as if it were nature, as if it were absolute truth. You know, we opened the presents on Christmas Eve. We opened them fast. We didn't save the paper. She opened them on Christmas morning. And you got to sit and watch while each person opens each individual present. That's insane. You know, it's like, it's so ridiculous. But
great
God, it's caused some of the worst trouble you've ever seen, as everybody knows.
I know, because my husband's Jewish and I'm not, so I can totally relate to that example. That's a perfect one. And I think that sort of goes into your next stage, too, which is independence, the stage where you talk about creating each other's solid sense of self. I mean, is that the same thing as being in the third stage, or is interdependent, or how are those two different?
Well, I take it from, I've always used this model of symbiotic bonding is infancy. The toddler stage is characterized by counter-dependence or oppositional bonding. So you have symbiotic bonding, then oppositional bonding, then you have sort of a peace treaty, parents and child, and the child begins to develop some sense of independence. And then in puberty, you really go for independence. And then when you fall in love and can sustain that love, then it begins all over again. In love is like symbiotic bonding. The impasse is like oppositional bonding. You're now trying to deal with your differences. The third stage is independence. You go from codependence to counterdependence to independence to interdependence. Because I can't give myself to you unless I know who I am. And that whole idea that the second stage, and I don't consider in love a stage because you're not working yet. You're nature's taking you down the stream together. And suddenly you have to start working to compromise and to work through your differences. And, you know, that people generally don't live together. And they may start living together when they're in love. But in love, you have that limerence where, you know, he killed a man and he told me on the second date, that's the greatest honesty I've ever seen. And he entrusted that with me. You know, you've got this crazy kind of symbiotic bonding when you're in love, and then you, when it stops, since you've never dealt with any of the differences, he's Jewish, you're Christian, or I had a Catholic fundamentalist, charismatic Christian Catholic fundamentalist marrying an Orthodox Jew one time. And and it was a disaster looking for a place to happen. You know, she was running around, thank you, Jesus. And I mean, it was just driving the guy crazy. And it drove me crazy in therapy. The thank you, Jesuses were enough to bore the hell out of anybody. Anyway, you know, I say try to marry somebody that you're compatible with, you know, ideally same religion, same ethnic background will save wear and tear on your colon. Because when you start fighting over all that stuff, generally your faith position is just what you've been taught. Very few people have gone through an exegesis of the Bible and finally rationally decided, here's my choice for a religion. You tend to just follow the religion you were brought up with.
Well, you were a theologian, right? You're a theologist.
I studied to be a priest for 10 years. So, and then I went to Rice for my doctorate and studied for four more years. I had, you know, some great Protestant scholars. In the Catholic seminary, I had the best Catholic scholars. In one place where there's ecumenity is on the interpretations of the scriptures. There's tremendous, you know, things that they all agree on. But anyway, it's also not too good. It's often not too good to have all that because it ruins Christmas for you. And you know, and Dennis the Tiny got the calendar wrong. Jesus was really born in 4 B.C. 4 years before he was born. And there was the infancy narratives, the wise men. That's all Jewish Haggadah Midrashim, where they were trying to make the stories fulfill the prophecies. But there's only in one gospel, and only two of the gospels have an infancy narrative. I mean, I could go on and on. That's another that's another rant I get into. But
you're now you're on this new wonderful, you know, journey of helping people in this sort of inter-emotional dependence on each other on this world of ours.
And you don't
preach it. I got to be honest with you. I don't hear any preaching, so I appreciate that about you.
Hear any what, my dear?
Preaching. You don't.
Oh yeah, I'm not trying to do that.
No, you definitely don't preach.
It's hard enough without preaching. No, I'm trying to tell the truth about it. Because you know, my first marriage ended after 20 years, and we never did, and both of us were therapists. We just never did the work that we needed to do. We had everybody else doing it except ourselves. And I think that's a big danger for therapists because there's a huge power in being the one that's always in control. And when you have to come and deal with the feelings, and, you know, when you do that inner child work, you're dealing with feelings or you are helpless. I mean, you didn't have any way out of that a lot of times. So the feelings are very raw.
So if you had something to tell the therapists that are listening now, either about a couple that they might have in their office today or even something about their personal life or their training, what's something that you might say today? We only have a few minutes left, and I want to make sure we save time to give them your contact info and tell them about you and what you have to offer. But what's one last thing you might want to leave them?
Well,
no pressure.
I was preaching the inner child, kind of doing inner child work, and I was still acting out sexually. And in 1981, I had an experience running on the highway where I thought I saw the face of Christ out on the horizon. He looked just like my Jewish marketing manager. but whatever, I took it to heart. And it said, do the work you're supposed to do, and money will never be a problem, because I had worried about money all my life. And anyway, I came back, and I broke it off with the woman. I just talked to her on the phone before the run. I didn't break it off that day, but I got in a group on sexual addiction. And when I went on national television, I was clean and sober from alcohol, clean and sober from everything, except, you know, sneaking cookies at night and stuff like that. But I was as clean and sober, you know, as a guy could be. That was 35 years ago, 34 years ago. And I'm almost 50 years sober. And
wow.
On the 11th, I'll be 50 years sober. So I'm
wow. Congratulations.
That was one of my goals. Of course, being a grandiose recovering addict, I had to say, well, I'm going to be sober for 50 years, you know. Anyway, I couldn't do the true inner child work until I'd done my own work. Mm. And that's what I'd say to every therapist, that, you know, it's like Freud putting people through psychoanalysis before they became, therapists. I think it's so important that you can't quite take people where they need to go if you can't go there yourself, in the feeling work, in the right brain work.
Right.
And then, you know, just try to be as rigorously honest as you can about your own life, because you're going to have blind spots where you're still in trouble in some area.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you don't express your feelings, you're not going to ask your clients to. Or you're not going to be able to validate them well enough, whatever. So, I mean, do your own work, clean up your own act. And I had to do that just because I was so out of control. Thank God for that, that I had that experience that I interpreted as something genuinely powerful, spiritually powerful. And in 1992, I realized I was making $500,000 a month.
Oh, my God.
That is the answer to a prophecy. I had no idea of it. My brother was worried. He said, do you know what's happening? Do you know what's happening? But see, once I got on national television, we'd run the series 10 weeks, and I'd come in on the 11th week, and we were having 5,000 to 9,000 people at every event. I mean, it was like...
Well, John,
I
just have to say, the fact that you have changed so many lives and... the fact that you have touched so many people, it's really emotional for me. I just want to thank you so much for being here.
Well, I am so happy to be here, and I love Imago, and I love the work you guys are doing. I really do. I think it's great work, and I appreciate your passion and the work and your work.
Well, it's really special and really powerful, and I want everyone to go on your website and buy and look at your products and really feel what they're drawn to, because I think you have so much to offer, and for them to really feel what they're drawn to. I know you have some product specials coming up, some Christmas specials. Can you tell people what offers that you have?
I kind of let other people run that, but I know they're going to discount things 40 to 60%, and I have all the PBS specials that I did, the homecoming one especially. I haven't done one on post-traumatic stress disorder yet, but all the workshops, all the books that I've written are based on PBS TV programs. I did 6 of those 10-part programs, and they're all on tape, and the workshops are on tape. And I'm hoping to write a manual for therapists for doing the inner child work the way I did it, whether... That's the, but I'm not saying it's the best way, but it is a way. And that was proven successful over a number of years. So they can call me at, I think you have it there.
Yes, and you have, you have a number here, but I think it's, your assistant said, if people want to contact orders@bradshaw@aol.com, they can get discounts anywhere from 40% to 60% off the list price. So
exactly.
If people want to order product specials from listening to this Imago Think Tank, you're going to get some huge discounts. So orders at bradshaw@aol.com, and just tell them that you listen to this Imago Relationship Think Tank, and you can get discounts up from johnbradshaw.com. So the website is johnbradshaw.com, and you can find out about all the products that John has been talking about his inner child work, his post-traumatic stress disorder book, which I want to encourage everyone to get, post-traumatic stress disorder, what to do when the honeymoon is over. And I want to thank everyone for being here today on the Imago Relationship Think Tank. This is Dr. Tammy Nelson, your moderator. To find out more about other think tanks that we have to offer, or to offer a topic or a guest or a book or an idea, you can contact me or you can contact Sarah at imagorelationships.org. And thank you again so much, Dawn. It's been such a pleasure to have you
thank
here.
You for having me, Tammy, and best of luck to all of you. Keep on keeping on the good work.
Thanks, John, and we'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.